area around the volcano. Occasionally, however, volcanic eruptions have global consequences. In 1815, for example, Mount Tambora, in what is now Indonesia, erupted and produced enough particles in the stratosphere to block incoming sunlight. The entire Earth cooled and turned 1816 into what came to be called the Year Without a Summer. Occasionally, however, the magma coming up from the interior cannot punch out from under Earth's crust to make an isolated volcano. In this case, the pressure grows until large areas of Earth's surface rupture in a titanic explosion and a massive outflow of lava. If the volume of that outflow is greater than about 1,000 cubic kilometers, you heard that correctly, 1,000 cubic kilometers, the event is called a supervolcano, and it can spew enough material to bury an area the size of Texas under 5 feet of rock. There are 20 active supervolcanoes in the world. The most familiar, perhaps, is in Yellowstone National Park in the United States. This supervolcano last erupted 664,000 years ago. If a similar eruption occurred today, much of North America would be buried under volcanic ash. Geologists have found evidence for no fewer than 47 eruptions of supervolcanoes in Earth's past, most recently 26,500 years ago in New Zealand, around the age of human cave dwellers. So, despite what you may see in apocalyptic sci-fi films, life on Earth, including the humans, will most likely survive the next eruption, even if not all organisms do, especially those who decide to get a closer look. Millions of years ago, yet another scale of volcanic activity known as large igneous provinces once threatened Earth's inhabitants. These eruptions dwarf supervolcanoes and can release hundreds of thousands of cubic miles of lava. The Deccan Traps, for example, an extensive geological formation in west-central India, date back to eruptions that occurred about 65 million years ago, while the Siberian Traps, a similar geological formation in northern Russia, originated from eruptions 250 million years ago. The timing of these outflows matches the two biggest mass extinctions in the history of life on Earth, and they cannot be ignored when looking for a smoking gun to answer why these extinctions occurred.
A tweet. The stark beauty of Yellowstone Park, atop a dormant supervolcano. Reminders that not all of our planet is a haven for life. Across many parts of Earth's surface, Mother Nature will just as soon see you dead. The Cataclysm of Mount Krakatoa. The red sky in Edvard Munch's painting, The Scream, is thought to be a result of material thrown into the atmosphere by the explosion of Mount Krakatoa in Indonesia in 1883. When it erupted, Krakatoa was actually torn open. Seawater rushed into the gap, causing an explosion massive enough to be heard in Australia, 2,000 miles away, the loudest sound in recorded history.
Unpredictable doomsday, impact. On an ordinary day, 50,000 years ago, an object the size of a 16-story building fell out of the sky over what is now the U.S. state of Arizona. Composed mostly of sturdy iron, the asteroid survived its fiery descent through the atmosphere and vaporized on impact, blasting out a mile-wide crater and creating a popular tourist attraction. The Barringer Crater, named for its landowner at a time when the crater's origin was a bit of a mystery, is now more appropriately called Meteor Crater. It serves as a poignant reminder that Earth inhabits a very dangerous region of space. Most asteroids in the solar system orbit between Mars and Jupiter, a region named the asteroid belt. As with Meteor Crater, in astrophysics we tend to be sensible about the names we give things. Occasionally, however, a random collision or the gravitational influence of a planet kicks an asteroid toward Earth. These asteroids aren't aiming for us, but if we happen to get in their way, if we happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, they will hit us, just like that hunk of iron hit Arizona. The most catastrophic impact we know of occurred 65 million years ago, when an asteroid about the size of Mount Everest hit Earth near a place now called Chicxulub on Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula. An asteroid this size, moving upwards of 10 miles a second, packs a punch with 1,000 times more energy than is contained in the entire human nuclear arsenal. This kinetic energy was converted to heat on impact, blowing out a crater more than 100 miles across and triggering the most recent of 5 mass extinction events. Dust from the explosion blanketed the upper atmosphere, blocking sunlight for years. The darkness, together with the tsunamis and fires ignited by falling debris, wiped out 2/3 of all the species of life on the planet, including all the classic dinosaurs we've come to love and fear from childhood. So, let's ask the unnerving question. Is there an asteroid out there with our name on it? Does a so-called extinction-level event await? NASA has dedicated several programs to detecting Earth-threatening objects. The best known is the Panoramic Survey Telescope and Rapid Response System, PAN-STARRS, which consists of telescope facilities located near the summit of Haleakala in Hawaii. Already, the project and others like it have discovered hundreds of thousands of asteroids, tens of thousands of which are classified as risky near-Earth objects, or NEOs. We expect this to be a fairly complete catalog of all the potential threats greater than the size of a football stadium. If we do find such a threat, we probably won't try to blow it out of the sky Hollywood style. Nukes would cause a chaotic and incalculable ricochet of debris, potentially launching deadly chunks of the thing even faster toward us. More likely, we'll find ways to nudge the asteroid bit by bit until it veers away from a collision course with Earth.
A tweet. Arizona is famous for its holes in the ground. Grand Canyon took millions of years to form. Meteor Crater took a few seconds.
The coming collision. In spite of the cosmic expansion discovered by Edwin Hubble, in which galaxies all recede from one another, galaxies that happen to be close to one another will feel a mutual gravitational attraction that is strong enough to override the local cosmic expansion. In other words, galaxies collide. In fact, astrophysicists have suspected for decades that the Milky Way and our twin neighbor, the Andromeda Galaxy, will collide in a few billion years. The details of this collision have become clearer in the last few years thanks to new data gathered by the Gaia spacecraft, which we met in an earlier chapter during our discussion of parallax and the distance ladder. Launched by the European Space Agency in 2013, Gaia's mission is to assemble a three-dimensional map of our galaxy by measuring the position in space of a billion stars with unprecedented accuracy. And although the primary function of the spacecraft is to look at stars in the Milky Way, Gaia can also detect light from bright stars in Andromeda. Based on these measurements, we can predict a scenario of the coming collision. About 4.5 billion years from now, the galaxies will approach each other for a side-swiping encounter. If we look only at the luminous parts, we'd call it a near miss. But a massive halo of dark matter surrounds each galaxy, and that's the gravity that matters here. After the Milky Way and Andromeda pass by each other, the attraction of those halos will cause us both to slow down, stop, and reverse course, colliding once again. Note that galaxies are not solid objects. In fact, there's mostly empty space between their stars. So a collision is not a one-time crash. The galaxies will emerge and get pulled back again, repeating in ever smaller recoils until the system settles down into a single jumbo galaxy named playfully, if unimaginatively, Milkomeda.
How empty are galaxies? If the entire continental United States of America contained just 30 bumblebees, any two of them would have a far better chance of randomly bumping into each other than would two stars in colliding galaxies. Can't picture that? How about this? If the sun were the size of the period at the end of this sentence, then its nearest star would be 4 miles away.
Open, closed, or flat. When thinking about the fate of the entire universe, rather than the fate of our own neighborhood, we must first understand the universe's basic geometrical structure. Imagine throwing a ball up from Earth's surface. Unless you're Superman or Captain Marvel, it eventually falls back to Earth as gravity slows it down. Throw the ball upward with that same speed, but from the surface of a small asteroid, and it will fly off into space, never to return. If you throw the ball at a perfect velocity to complement and counteract the pull of gravity, the ball might get stuck in an orbit. Thus, the fate of the ball depends on the speed and direction at which you launched it and the gravitational force it feels along the way. We can make an analogous argument about the fate of the Hubble expansion of the universe. If the universe has enough mass, enough gravity, to slow down those outrushing galaxies and turn them around, the expansion will stop and be reversed someday. We call this a closed universe. If, on the other hand, the universe doesn't have enough mass, the expansion will continue forever. We call this an open universe. The transition point between these two cases is called a flat universe, where it has precisely enough mass to stop the expansion and eventually stay in balance between the two scenarios. The amount of mass to accomplish this is said to close the universe. So when we think about the future of the universe, we have to consider three things. One, the amount of ordinary matter. Two, the amount of dark matter. And three, the amount of dark energy. The first two of these act through the traditional attractive gravitational force and together slow down the expansion. Dark energy, however, is a kind of anti-gravity operating in the vacuum of space, acting to speed up the expansion. There is another way to think about the long-term future of the universe, however, a way that depends on geometry rather than the actions of gravity. Here are three possible shapes for the basic structure of the universe: a closed universe, a flat universe, and an open universe. So, which shape represents the actual universe we live in? We ask not a theoretical question, but an empirical one. We need to measure something that allows us to choose among these scenarios. Referring to high school geometry, we could see if two parallel lines remain parallel to each other over a distance. From the figure opposite, it's clear this can only happen in a flat geometry. A closed geometry would see the lines swing back to meet each other, as do lines of longitude on Earth's surface. And although it's not technically possible to do such a measurement by sending laser beams out and seeing how they behave over long distances, we have at our disposal photons that have been traveling for more than 13 billion years. Our friend, the cosmic microwave background. In fact, astrophysicists analyzing those microwaves have resolved the question. We live in a flat universe. This simple fact deeply informs our sense of how the universe will end.
80 to 100 tons. The amount of space material that falls through Earth's atmosphere every day.
What is the matter? Once we know that our universe is flat, and that there is not enough gravity to close it, the next question that comes to mind is, how big a slice of cosmic pie are we? Let's look in turn at each slice of what composes the universe. Baryonic matter, 5%. Baryonic matter is stuff made of ordinary particles, the kind of matter we're used to. Stars, planets, asteroids, comets, interstellar dust clouds, black holes, and human beings are all made of baryonic matter. This familiar form of matter makes up only about 5% of the universe. A sobering fact. That means the entire history of science, from the earliest civilizations to the present, has been devoted to exploring only a tiny fraction of all that exists. On the other hand, we have, over the millennia, acquired a pretty good idea of what baryonic matter is and how it behaves. We're quite proud of what we can do with that 5%. Dark matter, 27%. You may remember this really should have been called dark gravity because that's precisely what it is. But we're stuck with the term dark matter, so we must roll with it, constituting a bit less than 30% of the universe. Even though we don't know what dark matter is, we know what it does, and more important, what it doesn't do. We know it exerts a gravitational force, and we can see the effects of this force in things like the rotation of galaxies, the structure of galaxy clusters, and the bending of light rays in phenomena known as gravitational lensing, first predicted by Einstein. Dark matter does not interact with electromagnetic radiation, light, and theorists have several notions of what it might be. Most current ideas assume that dark matter is composed of some sort of elusive elementary particles, but sophisticated experiments have yet to detect them. Dark energy, 68%. Dark energy constitutes both the biggest slice of the cosmic pie and the slice we know the least about. We know that it acts as a kind of anti-gravity, pushing galaxies apart, accelerating the Hubble expansion. But that's about it. At the moment, two leading theoretical contenders vie for the identity of dark energy. The most popular is that it represents the energy of empty space. In an early version of general relativity, Einstein included a term called the cosmological constant to allow for this possibility. Physicists who have tried to use quantum mechanics to calculate this energy find their answers are off by a factor of 10 to the 120th power. That's a 1 followed by 120 zeros. It's hard to get a mismatch that large between theory and observation. In fact, it's the most wrong calculation there ever was, ever. An alternative candidate for dark energy, called quintessence, borrows its name from ancient Greek philosophy, which held that in addition to the four familiar elements of earth, fire, air, and water, a fifth element existed only in the realm of the gods. Theorists suggest that dark energy might be a new kind of space-filling fluid whose effect is to speed the expansion of the universe. Whatever dark energy is, it makes up about two-thirds of all that drives the universe.
A tweet. The perennial cry to save Earth is odd. Planet Earth survives massive asteroid strikes. It'll survive anything we throw at it. But life on Earth will not. Einstein's blunder. Einstein introduced the cosmological constant because he presumed, like everyone else, that the universe was static and stable. But to maintain those states, he needed a force to counteract gravity. Had he not been swayed by this bias, he could have predicted that the universe was either expanding or contracting. He swiftly dropped the concept when Hubble discovered the universal expansion, and later called his cosmological constant the greatest blunder of my life. But because the cosmological constant does indeed exist, serving not to balance cosmic gravity but to override its influence altogether, Einstein's greatest blunder may have been saying that the cosmological constant was his greatest blunder. In other words, even when Einstein was wrong, he was right.
Options for the end. Traditionally, stories about the end of the universe begin with possibilities corresponding to open, closed, and flat systems. In a closed universe, the Hubble expansion stops and reverses itself at some future date. Matter rushes inward, collapsing to that original, unfathomably dense beginning. This scenario is called the Big Crunch, which may be followed by a new expansion, the Big Bounce. So a closed universe would be the precursor to a cyclic universe. Intriguing. But all data ever collected tell us that we don't live in a closed universe. The remaining two possibilities for the end of the universe, given that it is either flat or open, depend on the nature of dark energy. Early in its history, the universe had a lot of ordinary and dark matter jammed together, so that gravity was the dominant force in any volume of space, overcoming any manifestation of dark energy at the time. Consequently, the universe put on the brakes, slowing the Hubble expansion. By the time the universe was about 5 billion years old, the ordinary and dark matter had spread thin, weakening the dominance of gravity over all things. This paved the way for dark energy to dominate gravity, forcing an increase in the expansion rate. We're still in this era of accelerated expansion governed by dark energy. Here, we wonder whether or not dark energy is finite. The fate of the universe depends on the answer. If the amount of dark energy is finite, then its effects will dilute as space expands. In this case, gravity will eventually take over again, and the expansion will slow down, but will never end, as predicted for a flat universe. Perhaps, however, the amount of dark matter increases as the amount of space grows. Maybe it's a property of the vacuum itself. The more the universe expands, the thinner gravity gets. But the more vacuum there is, increasing the strength of dark energy relative to gravity. This expansion will keep accelerating in a runaway scenario, leading to a scary fate called the Big Rip, which some theories predict will begin in about 22 billion years. In this development, the separation between galaxies will increase at first, but then the expansion of space will start to separate the stars within galaxies. 3 months before the rip, solar systems dismantle. 30 minutes before the rip, the space between atoms in materials will increase to the point that all material objects, planets, rocks, people, will tear apart. In the end, the relentless force of anti-gravity will even tear those atoms apart, leaving an ever-empty collection of elementary particles in its wake. Until we know a whole lot more about dark energy than we do now, we won't be able to choose between the various end states of the Hubble expansion.
A tweet. One's quest in life should not solely be the search for answers. Why not find pleasure in posing the questions themselves?
The edge of the map of time. We have reached the limits of our theoretical knowledge. Beyond this, we're compelled to emulate the technique of medieval mapmakers who, when they reached the end of known territories, would write on the edge of the map, "Here be dragons," and go home. Watching the end of the universe. The lamps are going out all over Europe. British diplomat, Sir Edward Grey, 1914. It's one thing to talk about the end of the universe in abstract theoretical terms, but quite another to imagine what it might look like to an observer on Earth. For the sake of argument, let's pretend that this observer is suitably shielded from the laws of physics, which are bringing an end to everything else, and blessed with a sufficient lifespan to watch the entire show. Although what we see in the sky may be punctuated with various kinds of fireworks, the overall effect will be for the skies to gradually darken. Sir Edward Grey's quote, repeated previously and uttered at the beginning of World War I, captures the desolation of the future universe. The first few billion years will be unexceptional as the sun gradually brightens and Earth feels the concomitant effects. But thereafter, we will begin to notice something new in the sky. As the Andromeda Galaxy approaches in preparation for its collision with the Milky Way, it will become a larger and larger fuzzy patch of light. As the collision approaches, Andromeda's shape, as well as that of the Milky Way, will begin to distort in the sky, influenced by our mutual gravitational attraction. Oddly enough, as we have pointed out, the serial collisions of the galaxies probably won't have much of an effect on the sun or our solar system. Stars are just too widely spread for that to matter. When the sun enters its final stages as a red giant and then a white dwarf, we'll notice something else. The stars begin to disappear. Every star begins life by fusing hydrogen and ends life as a white dwarf or supernova or black hole, when its nuclear fuels run out. 5 billion years from now, our sun will become a cooling cinder in space, supported against gravity by its electrons. The electrons won't quit supporting it, but eventually the sun will cool to the temperature of the universe and stop radiating. It goes dark. The same fate awaits any star, no matter what path it follows to the end. Furthermore, as the stars die, we notice that the distant galaxies are disappearing as well. The effect of dark energy increases the space between galaxies in an overall acceleration of the Hubble expansion. Eventually, each galaxy will reach a point where the expansion of space between it and Earth becomes so large that the light it emits will never reach us. Like the stars, the galaxies wink out of existence one by one. In the end, a cold, dark universe surrounds us, populated by a thin soup of elementary particles and decaying black holes.
The far distant future. We can make some predictions about the next few billion years based on solid physics. Beyond that, our ideas depend more and more on conjectures about the nature of dark energy and elementary particles. With that disclaimer, we present a timetable for the far and distant future, estimated in years from the present. 1 billion. Earth loses its oceans. 4.5 billion. Sun reaches peak of red giant phase. Mercury, Venus, and Earth are swallowed. 5 billion. Andromeda Galaxy collides with the Milky Way. 6 billion. Sun becomes a white dwarf. 22 billion. The start of the Big Rip. The end. If no Big Rip, 100 billion to 150 billion. All galaxies beyond the local group leave the observable universe. 450 billion. All galaxies in the local group coalesce into a single galaxy. 100 billion to 1 trillion. The last waves of star formation that the universe will ever see. 1 trillion. The longest-lived stars in the universe begin to die. All stars that can be made have been made, and the universe plunges into darkness. A tweet. Will the universe end? Many ask. Yes. Not with a bang, but a whimper. Not in fire, but in ice. Not in light, but in darkness.
Chapter 10. What does no thing have to do with everything? Nothing ain't what it used to be. Is the entire universe a vacuum fluctuation? Cosmogenesis. Before the Big Bang. The multiverse. The fine-tuning problem. Classifying the multiverse. Is this really science? 10. By now, we're heavily invested in understanding what the universe is made of and how it works. But like the black type on a page, you see letters and words only where there's an absence of light. We call it ink, but optically, it's all places where the white of the page has been blocked from reaching your eyes. In books, the nothing is everything. So too in cosmology. It's hard, if not impossible, to talk about the existence of anything without tandem references to the existence of nothing. Like yin and yang, they complete each other. Aristotle tried to understand nothing as manifested by the absence of air. He confidently proclaimed that nature abhors a vacuum. His argument was simple. If a vacuum was created, then the surrounding air would rush in and obliterate it, proving nature's abhorrence. During the Middle Ages, this argument acquired a theological overlay when a vacuum was taken to symbolize the absence of God. The medieval Latin name for a vacuum, horror vacui, requires no translation. In fact, in the Condemnation of 1277, Stephen Tompier, the Bishop of Paris, named the belief in the existence of the vacuum as one of 219 errors condemned by the church, right up there with fortune-telling and incantations that summon the devil. We can point to the German diplomat scientist, Otto von Guericke, as the man who demonstrated the reality of the vacuum. In 1654, he performed a famous experiment where he simply put two metal hemispheres together, pumped the air out from between them, allowing atmospheric pressure surrounding the sphere to do its thing, and showed that teams of horses, 30 in all, couldn't pull them apart. With this demonstration, the notion of nothing changed, and the vacuum version of nothing became a standard tool in experimental science. The largest vacuum system in the world today is along the ring of the Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland. It's actually three separate systems, two to provide thermal insulation, like a thermos, and one to clear atmospheric molecules and any other stray atoms from the beam ring, so particles can pass unimpeded. It takes a full 2 weeks to pump the air out of the vacuum system, but when that is done, the residual pressure in the beam ring is 10 to the negative 13 atmospheres. For every 10 trillion molecules, you'll now find only one. In fact, the space inside the beam pipes in the LHC is emptier than interplanetary space, making it the emptiest place in the solar system. Clear sailing for the high-energy particle beams. You don't want them slamming into stuff they're not supposed to. Nothing ain't what it used to be. The development of quantum mechanics in the 1920s uprooted many scientific concepts of the day, and the concept of the vacuum was not spared. From Aristotle up to that point, whether or not you believed that the vacuum was a real thing, you thought about it in the same way. A vacuum is a region of space with nothing in it, period. That version of nothing was literally no thing. But the Heisenberg uncertainty principle changed all that. A particle can pop into existence out of nothing, so long as it disappears in a short enough time. We use the analogy of Cinderella at the ball. She could go, provided she got back by midnight. In the same way, we argued that virtual particles, particles that mediate the fundamental forces, are quantum fluctuations in the vacuum that can appear from nothing, provided they are reabsorbed within the time limits prescribed by the uncertainty principle. The implications for the vacuum of this quantum concept are profound. The traditional vacuum is a static, lifeless thing. The quantum mechanical vacuum, on the other hand, is a dynamic place, teeming with particles that pop into and out of existence quickly enough to satisfy Dr. Heisenberg. Speaking of popping, imagine that you have a special kind of popcorn. The kernels in this popcorn not only pop, as ordinary kernels of popcorn do, but they also unpop, revert from the fluffy white treat to the original condensed kernel. What will you see if you put these imaginary kernels over a flame? At first, you'll see kernels popping up pretty much at random. Soon, however, you'll see something else. One by one, again at random, the popped kernels will unpop and return to their original state. Your spooky popcorn is like the quantum vacuum. On average, there is no gain or loss of energy in the system, and it's a far cry from the original Aristotelian nothingness. This whole discussion sounds like something Alice would encounter in Wonderland. But rest assured, countless experiments verified the existence of this roiling quantum vacuum.
A tweet. Nature abhors a vacuum. Came from space illiterate people. In fact, nature just loves a vacuum. It's most of the universe.
Is the entire universe a vacuum fluctuation? American physicist Edward Tryon posed this question in 1973. He was the first person to investigate whether the laws of quantum mechanics might have something to do with the origin of the universe. He argued that there was no reason the universe couldn't have originated as a fluctuation, a rare one to be sure, of the quantum vacuum. This was an extraordinary suggestion. He was attributing the creation of the universe to the creation of a pair of virtual particles. The uncertainty principle, remember, sets a time limit on how long a virtual particle can last. The more massive a particle, the shorter lived it will be. For an electron-positron pair, it's only about 10 to the negative 21 seconds. A trillionth of a nanosecond. So how long could a universe possibly hang around whose mass equals 100 billion galaxies? Surely not for billions of years. More important, though, Trion's argument seems to violate a fundamental law of nature, the conservation of energy. How could the mass of all those galaxies be conjured from nothing? You can trace this kind of objection at least as far back as the ancient Roman philosopher Lucretius, who famously argued, "Nil posse creari di nihilo." Nothing can be created from nothing. The solution to this conundrum actually helps explain the origin of the universe. When we look at the universe, we see two different kinds of energy. One, alluded to earlier, is the energy locked up in the mass of ordinary particles. This energy is positive. The other kind is the energy locked up in the gravitational fields. This energy is negative. Negative energy. In one example of this concept, if you want to move an object from Earth's surface into space, you have to supply it with enough energy to climb out of Earth's gravitational well. One look at the fuel expended for any NASA rocket taking off, and you are reminded of the energy needed to put the rocket's payload into deep space, far enough away that Earth is no longer trying to pull it back. So to get there, the payload started from a state of negative gravitational potential energy, and after burning all that fuel, it ended in a state of zero gravitational potential energy relative to Earth itself. In another example, imagine you are on a level field watching someone dig a hole and make a pile of dirt. If all you saw was the pile of dirt, the process would look miraculous. A small mound suddenly appeared out of nowhere. But once you see the hole from which it came, the miracle vanishes. The person with the shovel created a hole and a pile of dirt, but started with no hole and no pile of dirt. All this means is that you can create a universe that has zero total energy, but as long as you keep making holes and dirt piles in it, your universe can be immensely interesting. Trion closed his paper with one of our favorite quotes. "Perhaps," he speculated, "our universe is simply one of those things that happen from time to time."
A tweet. "If you seek only easy problems to solve, then ultimately, there'll be nothing about you to distinguish yourself from others." The usefulness of uncertainty. The Heisenberg uncertainty principle does not reveal a spooky magic fact about the universe. Instead, it expresses a fundamental limitation on the act of measurement, which manifests most strongly in the world of small particles. The reason why you cannot know both the location and the speed of a particle at the same time is that the act of measuring one of them disrupts your ability to measure the other. Think of retrieving a coin that slipped between the cushions of a car seat. As you reach for it, the width of your hand parts the cushion some more, allowing the coin to slip farther out of reach. The act of reaching for the coin made it harder to reach the coin. Something else quantum physics has taught us is that you cannot know what you cannot measure. So Heisenberg's insight was to successfully elevate these practical facts to a principle of the universe. Trion kept on trying. Edward Trion tells the story about how, during a lecture by a visiting physicist, he blurted out the question, "Could the universe be a vacuum fluctuation?" Everyone laughed, assuming he was making a joke. But people still read his paper.
Cosmogenesis. Let's work through a scenario for the origin of the universe, one most cosmologists embrace. It starts with the quantum vacuum. The best way to visualize the pre-Big Bang universe is as a ball rolling down a hill. The higher the ball on the hill, the greater the potential energy it starts with. The very bottom of this hill is called the true vacuum state. If on its descent, however, the ball nestled itself into a pothole on the hill, it now finds itself in what is called a false vacuum state. A lot of energy is stored in the false vacuum. One tiny nudge out of the hole, and the ball continues on its own toward the true vacuum, releasing that potential energy. In the Newtonian world, the only way the ball can get out of the false vacuum is for someone to give it a push over the lip of the pothole. In the quantum world, however, there are several ways for it to escape without bothering to climb out. One of them is quantum tunneling, in which the thing in the pothole, a universe, for example, disappears and then instantly reappears outside of the hole to continue its slide down the hill. Many competing ideas related to this scenario exist. All include a strong, repulsive anti-gravity pressure. Something we see today as dark energy operates in the false vacuum. This is what powers the inflationary universe. Once the system arrives at the true vacuum, all the gravitational energy stored in the false vacuum must go somewhere, and in the inflationary scenario, it triggers the fireball of particles and radiation we call the Big Bang. You may have experienced this firsthand. Imagine a roller coaster where your cart starts high on a hill, chock full of gravitational potential energy. While you descend, you gain speed as your potential energy converts to kinetic energy. This manifests as inflation in the pre-Big Bang universe. When you get to the bottom, there's usually extra track allowing you to overshoot and gracefully come to rest. But suppose instead there was just a brick wall waiting for you. On contact, all of your energy instantly converts to an explosion, killing everyone on board. Calculations suggest that the energy in a false vacuum can be enormous. The energy contained in a cubic centimeter of false vacuum is greater than all the energy of the observable universe. That's plenty of energy to go around if you want to make more than one universe. Oddly enough, in the early days of the inflation hypothesis, one of the difficulties was not trying to get inflation started, but rather to make it end. The challenge was politely dubbed the graceful exit problem. The energy diagram for this scenario resembles a simple hill where the true vacuum at the bottom awaits you, and the slow roll down a shallow hill to get there is what allows a graceful exit after tunneling out of the pothole, the false vacuum.
Death by vacuum decay. Every so often, cosmologists offer another hypothesis for how the universe might end. One of these hinges on the true and false vacuums that jump-started our universe. What if our current universe exists only in a false vacuum? A high-energy event could punch us out of the pothole on a slide to the true bottom, unleashing a universe-ending fireball. In addition, our universe could theoretically tunnel through the side walls of the pothole without provocation and slide right on down to the true vacuum, also unleashing catastrophe as the true vacuum instantaneously obliterates us all and everything else in the universe. The good news is that the lifespan of a universe existing in a false bottom is expected to long outlive the current age of the universe. So you can rest easy tonight.
Before the Big Bang. We've now collected tools enough to grapple with another of those cosmically bedeviling questions. What existed before the Big Bang? Some scientists consider attempts to answer or even pose a question like this to be complete nonsense. To quote the great non-astrophysicist St. Augustine, "The world was made not in time, but simultaneously with time. There is no time before the world." In other words, if time came into existence with the Big Bang, it makes no sense to talk about time before the Big Bang. It's like asking, what is north of the North Pole? No matter which direction you go from there, you're headed south. Even if you get into a helicopter, you will only rise above the pole, not north of it. It's not that there's nothing north of the North Pole. It's that there's not even nothing north of the North Pole. The premise of the question is inherently flawed. When you think about it, in the universe of Pinocchio, with his proboscis lie detector, not all questions are valid either, with some leading to logical inconsistencies. But the false vacuum universe scenario at least gives us a way of framing a disallowed question. Posed this way, the obvious answer to what was around before the Big Bang is the quantum vacuum. This state presumably existed before the decay of the false vacuum. But how would you verify such a claim? One way is to find something we can measure in the current universe that depended on the state of the universe before the Big Bang, which unfortunately amounts to a search for the smoke from a gun, and not even for the smoking gun itself. Unfortunately, inflation fundamentally prevents us from doing just that. How? Why? Suppose we held in our hand a deflated balloon, wrinkled and twisted in all sorts of ways. If we inflated the balloon, a small enough creature, like an ant crawling on the surface, would think it's smooth and flat. Residents of Earth's surface know from space pictures and from other secondary methods that Earth is a sphere. But we are sufficiently small that, locally, the land looks flat to our senses. A good test of how flat Earth can look is to drive a car in any direction from Fargo, North Dakota. After the balloon is inflated, the crinkles disappear, or are greatly diminished, regardless of how gnarly it started out. In the same way, when we look at the universe after inflation, any evidence from before has been stretched clean, so to speak, leaving us no way to determine how the universe began. Even if we grant ourselves a vacuum energy beginning of the universe, another question lands on the table. Why did the false vacuum decay when it did? If the vacuum state existed for an infinite time prior, then why did it choose that moment 13.8 billion years ago to birth our universe instead of some other time? And that's as much of a philosophical and scientific frontier as anything else. In the end, questions about what the universe was like before the universe began may be unanswerable, no matter whether it makes sense to ask the questions at all.
A tweet. If Pinocchio said, "My nose is about to grow," I wonder what would actually happen.
The multiverse. With the widespread acceptance of the inflationary picture and the extraordinary success of quantum physics to help understand reality, however bizarre, we will assert that these two general truths must govern the origin of the universe. When you combine these two concepts, an extraordinary prediction emerges for free: the existence of other universes. Let's return to the ball rolling down the hill. In a Newtonian world, the state of the ball is described by its position and velocity, both of which can be known at the same time to unlimited precision. In the quantum world, however, such a description is not possible because of the uncertainty principle. Consequently, the state of the ball must be described in terms of probabilities. Until the position of the ball is actually measured, we can think of it as existing in all the possible states all at once. So what does the ball descending from the false vacuum to the true vacuum look like in the quantum world? There is a high probability that the ball will descend, but there's also a small probability that it hasn't left the pothole. If you find this situation confusing, welcome to the club. The quantum world isn't like the familiar world we live in, and the universe is under no obligation to make sense to the human mind. In an infinite ensemble of universes, all possibilities, no matter how improbable, will be realized somewhere. In this simple model of only two outcomes, there will be patches of the quantum vacuum where a Big Bang fireball was created, and other places where the system remains in a false vacuum. The result will be a collection of universes, each starting off at different times, each containing within it an observable universe like our own, and each separated from other universes by the rapidly inflating false vacuum. Inflation, in other words, is always going on somewhere, a phenomenon called eternal inflation. This picture is called the multiverse. To envision it, imagine a large collection of bubbles that never touch each other because the inflation of the intervening spaces keeps them separated. In principle, the fundamental structure of any one universe, the very laws of physics themselves and the value of the fundamental constants of nature, such as the speed of light and the charge on an electron, could be different from that of all other universes. This fact provides us with possible answers to yet another vexing problem in cosmology, the so-called fine-tuning problem.
The Big Bounce. Just as the false vacuum scenario provides a way to think about the question of what happened before the Big Bang, the Big Bounce is another pre-Big Bang hypothesis that allows us to contemplate the question. It proposes that after the universe reaches a certain point of expansion, it will eventually contract and condense into another infinitesimally small hot mass that will trigger another rapid expansion. This hypothesis allows the universe to have been doing so from an infinitely long time ago and to continue doing so for infinite time in the future, an endless cycle with no beginning and no end.
The fine-tuning problem. What would our universe be like if the gravitational force were different? If it were stronger, gravity might pull everything back soon after the Big Bang, rendering its lifetime too short for stars, planets, and life to form. If gravity were weaker, on the other hand, matter might not collect into galaxies, nor form stars or planets at all. Or consider the charge on the electron. If it were a lot weaker than it is, atoms couldn't form. If it were a lot stronger, on the other hand, atoms might not exchange electrons to form molecules, so there would be no chemistry. In either case, life as we know it could not exist. Both of these examples represent a fine-tuning of the universe. In fact, there's a cottage industry in the scientific community dedicated to figuring out how much wiggle room exists among the various constants of nature, yet still allowing life to develop. All these calculations point to a single conclusion. There is a very narrow range of allowed values for these constants if you want your universe to form life. Yet, life has developed. How else could you be reading these words? Reconciling the narrow band of allowed values with the presence of life has come to be called the fine-tuning problem. The multiverse saves the day. If an infinite number of universes exist out there, each with different laws of physics and different constants of nature, then just by chance, some of them will have the combination of laws and constants that will fall within the narrow band that permits life. In those universes, life might also wonder why their universe is so finely tuned. This solution to the fine-tuning problem is a cosmological version of what statisticians call the Texas sharpshooter argument. Imagine someone shooting bullets at random at the side of a barn. When the shooting is over, someone goes up after the fact and draws a bullseye circle around a cluster of bullet holes that happen to have landed near one another. You wouldn't do this and then compliment the shooter's accuracy. For the same reason, you shouldn't compliment our universe just because it happens to be among the very few that can form and sustain life. The bullseye searches for and positions itself on the only universe compatible with its existence. Classifying the multiverse. Sooner or later, somebody was bound to devise a classification scheme to impose a little bit of order on this new frontier. In this case, that somebody was Swedish-American astrophysicist Max Tegmark. He suggests the following four categories of multiverses. Level 1. Between the edge of our observable universe and the larger solo bubble universe encasing it are multiple other universes, not entirely unlike ours. We can't see them and they can't see us. We exist outside of one another's realm. Level 1 multiverses are a little bit like scattered ships at sea, all sailing beyond each other's visible horizon. They can peer into their own horizons at every direction, but they are so far separated they can't see one another at all. Meanwhile, they all coexist in the same ocean. We know they come from the same physics stock as we do, Our equations tell us so. The initial condition may be different, though. For example, some of them may contain different combinations of matter and energy, and some may have sufficient mass for their gravity to overcome their expansion, putting them in the Big Bounce Club of universes. If there is an infinite number of these universes, then all combinations of matter, motion, and energy, all possibilities, are realized from one universe to the next. That means, for example, there is a universe out there with another version of you, but listening to a different book and sporting purple hair. In fact, there may be countless versions of you, some with your same memories, making all the decisions you wish you had made. The possibilities are endless. This is the multiverse familiar to science fiction readers, endless parallel universes. And that's just the first of four levels. Level 2. A level 2 multiverse contains many bubble universes. It's the kind of multiverse that eternal inflation generates. Here, bubble universes, each containing their own retinue of level 1 universes, can express a different number of dimensions as well as different physical constants, completely changing the behavior and structure of matter and energy within them. That being said, level 2 universes are otherwise governed by the same laws and equations that we are. But now, with endless palettes of fundamental constants to choose from, we arrive at a simple solution to the fine-tuning problem. Just find the bubble universe whose physical constants allow life and, within that, find the universe whose initial conditions gave rise to stars and planets. That may be the universe you live in. Level 3. The Level 3 multiverse, often referred to as the Many Worlds Hypothesis, is the side-by-side ensemble of all the Level 2 multiverses. In this construct, all quantum states are realized at all times as a branch point in time. In other words, every action and every decision within a world splits in that moment into other universes with different outcomes of that single action. In our universe, a single brain neuron firing might be the difference between one life-altering decision and another. So, whatever memory you've conjured after hearing that sentence, you can contemplate another you in a level 3 parallel universe far, far away who made a different decision, whose neuron fired a different way, and whose life thereafter is completely different from yours. Level 4. These are the multiverses associated with all possible mathematical structures. In a level 4 universe, Newton's laws might take on many different forms. For example, gravity might not depend on the mass of the objects exerting a gravitational force. Or there are places where systems naturally become more ordered over time. That would be freaky. Observing events in that universe would be like watching a film run backward. Omelets would naturally deconstruct and revert into eggs and piles of cheese. Shards of a shattered cup on the floor would spontaneously reassemble and jump back up on the table, poised to be filled with hot chocolate. We tried hard, but the full bag of tricks contained within a level 4 multiverse lies far beyond our physical or even philosophical abilities to visualize or even analogize. Is this really science? Sometimes theoretical physics can become so difficult to comprehend with our humble human brains and minuscule lifespans relative to the universe that philosophers step in and give it a go. You cannot read very far into the multiverse literature before you start seeing references to 14th century philosopher and theologian William of Ockham, who is credited with declaring that multiplicity ought not to be posited without necessity. If you're into Latin, he said it this way: Pluralitas non exponenda sine necessitate. And if he were around today, he surely would have invented the KISS principle. Keep it simple, stupid. Now known as Occam's razor, his point is a thoroughly embraced reality check on the complexity of our ideas. Have we gone too far? Too much conjecture? Too much philosophizing? All four levels of multiverse we've talked about involve systems with which we cannot, even in principle, communicate. If the central tenet of the scientific method is that all propositions must be tested against experiment and observation, then how can statements about the multiverse be part of science? And let's face it, the farther away we get from the level one multiverse, the more reality fades into the shadows of our ignorance. Critics of the multiverse idea point out that the predictions we can make about other universes using our best particle theories can never be tested, again concluding that it is not real science. Supporters, on the other hand, point out that the theory is very well supported, founded on quantum mechanics and the inflationary universe. Furthermore, it is not necessary that every prediction of a theory be verified before the theory is accepted. In the 1920s, for example, the physics community accepted general relativity based on only two tests, oddities in the orbit of Mercury and the bending of starlight during the 1919 eclipse of the sun. All the other triumphs of the theory, the existence of black holes, gravitational redshift, and gravitational waves, for example, came decades later. As it happens, theoretical physicists, always a clever lot, have already started thinking of ways to detect phenomena in our own observable universe that would reveal the existence of other universes. To take one example, if our own universe happened to suffer a glancing collision with another universe in our distant past, characteristic imprints of that encounter may reveal themselves in the map of the cosmic microwave background. They're still looking. Many questions about our own humble universe, perhaps just one of an infinite number of universes, remain to be answered. We implore you, dear listener, to continue to stoke your curiosity and to ask the impossible cosmic questions. For the goal of our short life is not to find the answers, but to search for new places to stand so that we can formulate questions not previously imagined. Along that journey, as you shape your own cosmic perspective, we bid you, as always, to keep looking up.
For the birds, physicist Richard Feynman is known to have said that the philosophy of science is about as much use to scientists as ornithology is to birds.
This concludes the reading of Cosmic Queries, StarTalk's Guide to Who We Are, How We Got Here, and Where We're Going, by Neil deGrasse Tyson, with James Treffel, edited by Lindsay N. Walker.